Hello, everyone. This is Cassie Burns, co-founder of All Your Data. I'm an attorney who's been using AI and machine learning for 10 years. I love data and love talking to people about data, and that's what this podcast is about. Each episode of Cassie and will feature a new guest. Each guest comes from a different background with a different approach and attitude towards technology. We'll talk about their experiences and hopefully we'll learn a thing or two. Thanks for joining. Let's get started with Cassie and Cassidy Reed. Cassidy, thank you so much for joining us here today. Cassie and Cassidy, I think we make a perfect pair there. Again, thank you so much for joining. For my audience, if you don't know Cassidy, she's the founder of a group called Women in Automation, a wonderful organization that is continuing to pick up steam. I know that you have an event planned in New York City in November. Unfortunately, I'm not able to go, but really being a vanguard out there, trying to rally the troops, get more women involved in automation, which is tied closely to broader conversations, I think, to AI and emerging technologies. I've given you a very brief intro, but I'd love for you to tell the audience about yourself.
Of course. Yes, Cassie, thank you so much again for having me on your podcast. Like we said, I'm Cassie Reed. I'm the founder of Women in Automation. I'm currently based in Austin, Texas. I've spent over a decade in the intelligent automation space, advising Fortune 500 companies on their digital transformation and implementing automation programs that have driven significant operational impact. Women in Automation is a community I founded to empower and connect women in this field. And really, our mission is to foster diversity, inclusivity, and which I believe is essential to driving innovation and progress in automation technology.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. We've talked about this offline. I know a lot of really brilliant women that are really working in the weeds of AI and technology. And sometimes we're not always granted a seat at the table of leadership or thought leadership. But I think that having people like you trying to create a space and invite people up to the table and encourage, empower others to kind of put themselves out there, I think that's great. And part of that is you just recently this week went to an event that's kind of on those themes, on trend for those topics, right? Can you tell the audience a little bit about that event you went to?
Yes, of course. This past week, I was at the Grace Hopper Celebration in Philadelphia, and it's the world's largest conference for women and non-binary people in technology. So the Anita B. organization put it on, and it's named after the computer scientist Grace Hopper. And really, it's just a conference for attendees to learn, network, and celebrate their achievements in technology. So it was great to be in a huge, I think there was like 14 or 15,000 women there and non-binary folk. And it was just such a powerful and impactful event with keynote speakers, workshops, panels, networking events, and so on and so forth. So I was invited, part of Women in Automation, as one of their 19 sister organizations to really help drive the needle forward in diversity, equity, and inclusion in the automation and technology space.
That's so exciting. I saw a few other people in my LinkedIn feed attending this event, and I got some major FOMO, and I'm going to have to maybe try to go next year. So is it one day, a couple of days? If you could tell just a little bit more about the event, your experiences.
So the event, I believe it's from Tuesday to Friday. Unfortunately, because of the hurricane, I had to leave early and had to make it back on time. But it was such a great event. So many wonderful people were there. And I think I heard from America Ferreira, who was one of the keynote speakers. But now there were such impactful women who have done just so many amazing things in the world of technology. And they're really actively pushing forward, including women in the space, and saying that this is not just for men, this is for everyone, you know, and they're really making it welcoming and encouraging. And in some ways, to be honest with you, Cassie, it felt like a Taylor Swift concert with just all that positivity running around.
I love it.
But great feeling. I don't know if anyone's been to the Taylor Swift Eras Tour, but it's just a happy, free event. And I felt very much like that at the Grace Hopper Celebration.
I feel like women are having a movement. If you look at last year, Barbie was huge box office draw. Yeah. Taylor Swift's concert was huge. Beyonce's concert was huge. I just feel like we're seeing over and over, we're seeing Chapel Rowan being such a huge driver of consumer interest. I just feel like women are having a moment. And I do feel like some of it's because we're not just going to be content to just sit by and see it happen. And maybe that's some of the beauty of social media, is it lets people who are sometimes disenfranchised or underrepresented get together on through social media and say, well, this isn't good enough for us. We're not just going to be quiet. And, you know, we're seeing that with organizations or groups getting called out if they have all male events where it's a conference that only men are speaking, like panel after panel. Like, people are paying attention and calling them out. The whole thought that there aren't enough women in tech is a misnomer. People have been in tech. Women have been in tech. Non-binary have been in tech for a long time. Before non-binaries, they were there. It's not called that, I'm sure. But I think that we just have to make sure we have a voice, we have a seat at the table, and have leadership opportunities. So
I couldn't agree more. I think so many times I've seen where there's an all-male panel event, but they do have a women in automation section, or they have a little women section, and they just talk about women in that, but they don't have women involved in every conversation, which I think women should have a seat at every single table. So it was really great to have that represented at the Grace Hopper event.
That might have to be a 2025 event for me. I'll have to look into that. But instead of looking ahead to the future, I want to look back. I want to hear about your beginnings in automation. I want to hear you talk a little bit about RPA. And AI has become the topic du jour, but it, especially the flavor of AI we have now, it's built on years of people working with various aspects of technology and data. What was that experience like, ground floor, working with RPA and automation?
Yeah, of course. With automation, it has dramatically changed over the past decade. So I've been in the space for a decade now. And I was, you know, just to give you an example, I was the fifth hire at Genpact's digital transformation department for their consulting. Really started with RPA there, robotic process automation, which was really a game changer for a lot of organizations. Automation tools like RPA can handle repetitive rule-based tasks with exceptional accuracy. They still rely on humans for the strategy, the governance, the continuous improvement, but it was really a huge shift that we were seeing in organizations. And now, a lot of times it was to handle a lot of low-hanging fruit. But now here we are a decade later, and all the low-hanging fruit is gone in a lot of these Fortune 500 organizations because they've seen the impact of RPA, they've seen the impact of automation, and now they're going for larger, more strategic opportunities. And as you know, and all we can hear about online right now is generative AI. And so I think that platforms like OpenAI and others that have given access, free access to people to allow them to play with this technology, it's really opened their eyes and made it a less scary opportunity. Where I remember back with RPA, it was very much like trying to teach them through it, make sure people aren't scared about it. I had some people refuse to use the automation once it was implemented just because they didn't trust the technology. And now that couldn't be further from the truth. People understand the technology. They understand how well it works. And they're excited to go after bigger and better things.
Well, and I think generative AI adds a little bit of spice to that, like, automation kind of dimension. Because I'm sure in the RPA systems you built out, you want repeatable results. You want somewhat form-driven outputs. And we don't necessarily get that with generative AI. I mean, I know I built out some custom GPTs through OpenAI's my Plus subscription. And one great example is the email that I send out to guests of this podcast. I built one based off of emails that I trained on emails I previously sent. And my input is simply draft an email to Cassidy talking about like these like five topics or whatever. And the form of it kind of changes over time. It veers, and sometimes it doesn't really touch on the things that I want it to, and I have to like course correct a little bit, but do you find that there are people out there now interested in generative AI and they want to integrate generative AI in their operations, but they haven't really thought about the best way to implement it?
Yes. So I'm so happy we're touching on this topic. Exactly, really what my job is. So as an intelligent automation consultant that I'm really focused on more of the strategy side, a lot of times now we're having top-down executives say, okay, they're telling their team, go out, we need to implement generative AI because our board wants us to do that. But they don't know where. And I think that's just such a backward way of looking at things. We really need to be looking at the use case itself and making sure, okay, what is the best technology rather than, okay, here's the technology, what's the best use case for it? So to me, I think you're putting the cart before the horse a little bit with, understand the desire. And, you know, with technology like generative AI, there are a lot of great use cases, but it is very dependent on the, you know, actual process itself and what the North Star goal is of that organization.
And I would imagine you would want to be fairly organized kind of coming into those conversations with someone like you as a consultant. Automation, whether it's older school RPA or it's maybe the integration of AI agents. If you don't have your own like existing process documented in some way, you may need to do your homework first, right? Like you might need to take that step. Having those SOPs in place, I would imagine would be a great starting point. In essence, a playbook for your automation planning. Is that, I mean, would you agree with that? Is that a great?
Yes.
You can agree more?
Cassie, you really are. This is why I've created a few go-to-market opportunities and playbooks for the companies I've worked at, where really we need to be looking at people, process, and technology, and in that order as well. One of my favorite quotes is from Bill Gates, and he talks about how implementing automation to an inefficient opportunity will only magnify the inefficient. So really what we need to do is make sure that process is as efficient as possible first and then implement the technology and tool on top of that. So yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. That's really, you know, I think it's important to look at the holistic point of view and create a prioritized opportunity pipeline based on your organization goals, based on the ROI. And if it just so happens to line up that you get a, you know, amazing tool like generative AI, and that's one of your top goals, then let's move forward with that. But let's really make sure we're looking at that holistic picture rather than just that small piece.
And I also think that there's always points of failure, you know, and I think anyone who's actually gotten their hands dirty with operations and, you know, the Holy Trinity, people, process, and technology is always last. You think of people and process and the technology. All three of them can have points of failure in them. The people can have points of failure, without a doubt. The process can have points of failure, and the technology can have points of failure. I always tell people I'm really intrigued by the idea of knowing that there are going to be points of failure at any of these steps, and what can you do to minimize it? What fail-safes can you put into play? And sometimes you don't know until you actually play with it and get your hands dirty. But that's where playing with the technology in a low risk personal environment really is important, because people see these tool automation, generative AI, robotics, and they think this is all like an easy button, but it's not. Like, you have to work at it, don't you?
Very much so. And I think it just speaks to the importance of proof of concepts, proof of value, making sure that they actually understand what the technology is going to do and how it's going to be impacting their business. This is why I'm a big advocate for hypercare. So really, once you go live with a product, you really need to have that team still sitting back, watching everything as it's going live and making sure that the tool's running properly, the people in the process are running smoothly with this new technology. But a lot of times people tend to overlook that hypercare, which is that critical component at the very end, once the technology has already been put live.
Well, and I think we hear echoes of that in things like the EU AI Act, where, you know, we're seeing AI laws emerge where they talk about your risk management systems, your quality management systems. That's the life that should be ongoing for the life cycle of the use of that product. NIST AI risk management framework says the same thing. And I think that just really, we're really good at starting something as humans, but we're not always as good at double checking things, or we're not always good at validating results, or we're not always good at cleaning up data on the back end, whatever it is. And I think that that is an important thing to appreciate and acknowledge, that this technology is wonderful and very powerful, but you also have to have that hypercare. I've not heard of that phrase before, so that's great. Having that inclination to quality check things, because you're like, is there something weird here with this output? Let me pull that thread. Like, and that's where being curious, I think, is a very valuable tool. I also think that's where having imposter syndrome and you always think you screw something up, that's really important in some ways, because for me personally, that's made me my career be very hypercritical of my own work product and double check and triple check, or go, what I'm doing right now has a lot of little points of failure. What can I do to minimize those points of failure so I don't have to triple check myself? I think having that mindset, not everyone has that. And it's really important the more we use technology to have that mindset.
Definitely. No, I couldn't agree more with you.
Who knew having imposter syndrome would be a strength, Cassidy? So
I love it.
Well, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about what you're seeing as far as automation with generative AI. That seems to me a harder nut to crack. I think that people might be disappointed by it because it's not going to be as repeatable in the exact same way that you might want, or other challenges that you've seen with generative AI or AI more broadly. One that I see is that people don't realize how much time you have to put in on the front end, knowing that on the back end, that's where you maximize your efficiencies, but you do spend more time on the front end. Would love to hear those pain points that you've experienced or have worked through with clients.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that one of the biggest pain points that we're seeing, and it's time and time again, is the data. If the data is not good, the tool is not going to be good. And I don't think people understand how important it is to have that cleaned up, pristine data in order to get what you're looking for. So if your data is a mess, your tool, your outputs, they're not going to be right. It's really having to backtrack those steps and make sure you're prioritizing your data and that it's, you know, stored properly. But really, at the end of the day, automation and AI are just tools to enhance that human capability and really not replace them, in my opinion. The keys to striking the right balance between automation and human oversight, leveraging technology to reduce errors and increase efficiencies while ensuring that we maintain control and governance over these systems, is critically important. Really, as we move into the future, it's clear that automation will continue to reshape these industries and the role of humans will evolve alongside of it. My advice really is for anyone navigating this space to stay curious, like you always say, Cassidy, and embrace continuous learning and recognize that diversity in automation in both terms of people and perspectives will lead to the best outcomes.
I think the data curation is a very well-timed comment, Cassidy. I personally believe that data curation is going to become increasingly important as we go. Now, knowing from my legal background that with the launch of GDPR many years ago, that kicked off a whole exercise in data mapping. What data do you have? What's the data flow? You know, cross-jurisdictional data flow. What's transferring? What's in the data? But even data curation, it's an extra step above, right? It's not just where's your data, where is it going, what is it? It's what's your best data? Mm-hmm. What is your best data for this use case? And we've all said, I've said this many times on my episode, and I said this before as an e-discovery professional, garbage in, garbage out. If your data's not great, your output's not going to be great. That's probably why some of these tools, these publicly available generative AI tools, they give funky responses or whatever. It might be because they were trained on some funky data. You just never know, right? So as organizations start thinking, we want to build something, we want to build tools in-house, and we need to have data. Data is the gold of this era. It's the oil of this era. You want the good quality stuff. You don't want just any stuff. You want to know, I'm taking the time to train this technology. It's the best examples of contracts, or it's the best examples of this data set that We've done everything we can to minimize bias. And the struggle is we love creating data. We're not so great at keeping it in order and cleaning it up because that's a not fun job, but it's tedious and time consuming and expensive. So I imagine sometimes getting clients to even realize the benefit of spending the time and money on data curation is challenging.
I couldn't agree more. It's something that it's a constant battle, right? Because like you said, the risks of poor data in generative AI completely impact the entire project. When your AI systems are trained on low quality or biased data, the consequences can be so far reaching. For instance, with generative AI models might produce outputs that are incorrect or misleading if the underlying data isn't clean in your organization. This can lead to poor decision-making, in some cases, compliance and legal risks, you know, at worst. So, another key issue is that model drift. As data changes over time, AI models need to be retrained regularly to stay relevant. And we don't want to monitor data going into these systems and the outputs will start to degrade if we don't do that. And that's when the errors really start creeping in and often underdetected for long periods of time.
And again, you add on automation bias and you add on that inclination. It's a well-oiled machine. And there can be a lot of problems there. And the risk is huge. The legal risk is huge. Not only could there, it seems like every week there's a new AI law getting passed. And then you have the regulatory agencies in the U.S. that have certain authorities, some of which include AI disgorgement, where the government can say, that algorithm was trained on data that is so biased or has so many problems, that data, you got to get rid of the algorithm. It's gone. So that's a huge investment. Not only the investment in training it, preparing it, testing it, validating all the front end, but then if it's a tool you're using for a key aspect of your core business and it's gone, what's your backup plan then? Hopefully, do you get the feeling that people are realizing there's a sheriff in town now? We kind of have to start paying attention to this stuff or people running willy-nilly.
I know that you were talking about you feel like there's an AI law getting passed every day now, which it is, but not to the extent that we need it. And I do think that there needs to be way more regulation in AI and there needs to be an ethical community that's coming up with this for our nation. I think AI and the technology is quickly surpassing, you know, what laws we have in front of it. And so I think that we need to really hone in as a nation or even globally what these AI laws are going to be. And that's just a personal opinion on it. But I think that there's just, how do you stay on top of these biases? If there's not that overarching, it's so expensive to do that. So unless you have that regulation and that overall compliance that you need to reach, I'm scared that companies aren't going to be doing this themselves. And so I think it's so important that we really put these measures into law and to act to make sure that all companies are held to a similar standard when it comes to their automation.
And it's definitely not companies intentionally inserting biases into their models. It's there are people out there playing with these tools and trying to break it and get it to say things they shouldn't say. And it's not only like a game of whack-a-mole where they've really got to put some controls in place, but it's a challenging thing. It's a fascinating thing. But it is something you have to take seriously all the way from cradle to grave with the rollout of these tools. So something else I really want to hear about is cradle to grave. Hear about your startup of Women in Automation. It's something that I think you started up a few years ago. And I would really love to hear your inspiration for that and kind of what you see, you know, in the near future.
Yeah, of course. I started Women in Automation about 2.5 years ago or so, where I was the head of advisory for an organization. And I noticed I was one of only few women at that organization. And I asked our CEO, why was that? And I said, it's just harder to find women in this space. And so I was like, okay, since I'm head of this practice, I'm going to go out and find more women. And he said, good luck. I'm here for you. But yeah, go out and find them. And so I really took that as a challenge and created Women Automation for the sole and selfish purpose of hiring more women under me within my automation practice. And now it's just spun into something so much bigger than that. And I'm so proud to be a part of this community where now we're really looking at networking events, sponsoring women to upskill their current abilities in automation and networking opportunities, job opportunities, you name it. So it's just been a huge experience. It's just been so wonderful. And I couldn't be more proud to be a part of it. But we have our biggest event coming up. I think you just might mention this earlier, Cassie, on November 13th in New York City. We are hosting a 80-person event at FanDuel, sponsored by FanDuel. And we're gonna have a panel of very wonderful women who I know some are CEOs of their own generative AI companies. Some are part of Microsoft, Amazon, Google, speaking on all of their experience in automation and getting advice on how to propel forward and how we can help each other as women in this space. So it should be a very moving and profound event that I'm really excited to be a part of. So if anyone's in New York City on November 13th, feel free to click the registration link that Cassie will provide in this. And hopefully we can see you there.
Yeah, absolutely. And if anyone wants to attend remotely, is that an option? Or will some of the panels be available for streaming after?
They will be available for streaming afterwards. So yeah, no live streaming, unfortunately, for this event, but we are excited for everyone to watch on YouTube later on. But in the meantime, you can event. If you can join locally, that would be amazing.
I think that's wonderful. So this is your first in-person event. Is it the inaugural with the hopes that it will become an annual event?
Well, no, this is not our first event in person, but this is going to be our largest one to date. So we're super excited about the event. This is our first one in New York City, which I feel like is such a natural automation hub, technology hub, really focused on innovation in that area. And yeah, we're really excited about it. FanDuel is sponsoring, like I said, so there will be drinks and appetizers, and it should be a very wonderful event. Yeah, we're excited.
I love it. And I would think it's probably not that women aren't interested in it. It's probably that women aren't aware of automation as a career path. Is that the case?
I would say so. It was so funny. And this is such a great topic, Cassie, because we were actually talking about this at the Grace Hopper celebration with a few women where, you know, a lot of times if you look at these job applications, you need X amount of years of experience in automation. You need this qualification and this qualification. And realistically, these companies, they would hire someone who had a fraction of that experience because not a lot of people have experience in intelligent automation right now. It's very rare. And so if you just get experience in artificial intelligence, machine learning, hyperautomation, the entire suite for just 2 or 3 years, you're almost in some areas considered an expert. So I don't want to, you know, it's something that for women tend to not apply to jobs unless they tick every single box. Mm-hmm. Women are much more likely to apply to jobs that they only tick a few boxes. And so I think automation is one of those where emerging technology is a bit maybe confusing or something. Oh, I don't have that experience in that yet. And you start downplaying yourself. And, you know, as women, we tend to do that. So I want to encourage women to show them, hey, this is a new frontier for everyone. If you start today, you're getting in on the ground floor. So it's a really exciting time to be a part of this industry.
I think that's exactly right. We need those communities to hype each other up because you are absolutely right. So many women I know, they're like, oh, I don't exactly know that. I don't, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, man, you are excellent at working an Excel spreadsheet and getting things organized and building out a process. And you learn really quickly. And like, those are all skills that while you may not have the specific skill of automation or whatever, you have all the elements that it wouldn't take too much time to, you know, really, really go out there and get a little bit of experience and do a great job or do some things in your free time that build on that so you can at least speak intelligently with your own practical experience. So I think you're exactly right. I think so much of it is just hyping each other up and saying like you, and I see this in e-discovery where we have experience with AI, machine learning as AI. Now I would not have considered machine learning AI, but now it's considered probably traditionally considered AI, and now it is being discussed in the broader concepts of AI. And so many people, my colleagues, are like, oh, I don't really know it. I'm like, you have been using AI, you know, in terabytes of data. in huge processes that have to pass muster with an opposing party. Like, these are skill sets that other people would die for. You just have to learn. We have the voice of doubt in our ear. We have to learn to ignore it sometimes. So it's sometimes good because it makes you double check your work and have good QC processes in place. But you can't let it hold you back. So I love that you're doing this, Cassidy. Absolutely. Well, Cassidy, we're here at the end of this podcast. I would love to hear like some closing thoughts that you might have for the audience.
This has been such a valuable discussion, Cassie. And at the end of the day, as we continue to embrace automation and generative AI, we really need to remember that data quality is the foundation of these technologies. Poor data can lead to biases, inaccurate outputs, which is why human oversight, continuous monitoring, and strong data governance are absolutely essential for the future of automation. For those who are listening, who are exploring automation or looking to build their careers in this space, remember that there's a role for everyone, and communities like Women in Automation are here to support you. Whether you're just getting started or you're an industry veteran, there's always room to learn, innovate, and contribute to shaping the future of these technologies.
I think that's wonderful, Cassidy. So inspiring. I know I've learned so much from you, so thank you so much for being here, and I'm sure my audience has as well. And to my audience, thank you so much for joining, and we look forward to you on the next episode of Cassie and...
Angel. Hey,